Welcome on this glorious day of independence. Some words from our Declaration of Independence. I suppose you know that in the Declaration of Independence, there is some fetching. Now, this is about King George III, but I can't help it if you sort of think of British Petroleum. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. Nor have we been wanting in attention to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts made by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our emigration and settlement here, bringing to mind Arizona. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They too have been deaf to the voice of justice and consanguinity. We must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends.
Join with me in an attitude of prayer. Because of those who came before us, we are this. Because of those who will come after us, we will remain. Because of their successes, we too aspire to success. This we bless. Because of those who came before us and their failings and our own failings, we understand the nature of humility, and we are learning to trust. Because of, and in spite of, the horizons of their vision, we too dream and have vision. This too. Let us remember all these and their visions, our own vision. Let us open the ears of our hearts in attention, remembering to praise where praise is called for, remembering to think and speak and act in alignment with our hearts, to live in the moment, to love mightily, and bow. It is time now to sit quietly and to walk in deep presence as we honor the spirit of this moment in meditation and in the lighting of candles. Come now, let us bow together.
From the Constitution. Article 1. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Article 14. Are you listening, Arizona? All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. We honor life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Amen.
Rabbi Michael is correct in saying Omein or Amen at the end of some of these words. Let it be, and so may it go forward. I heard this morning from Shannon that she had read a news story about someone who had taken the original notes of the Declaration of Independence and was doing one of these infrared scans of it, and they saw that where Jefferson first used the word citizen, he had smudged out subject. How often we feel like subjects of our government rather than citizens. And this is the topic that I want to bring to you today, the amazing responsibilities and rights of our citizenship. The sermon is entitled, A Government by the People. About patriotism, George McGovern wrote, "The highest patriotism is not a blind acceptance of official policy, but a love of one's country deep enough to call her to a higher plane." Thomas Paine's words, his plea to move beyond the pale of a sunshine patriot in his work, The Crisis, is about as eloquent as it gets. These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph. You see, what we obtain too cheap, we esteem too lightly. It is dearness only that gives everything its value. Heaven knows how to put a proper price upon its goods, and it would be strange indeed if so celestial an article as freedom should not be highly rated. It is Independence Day, a celebrated national holiday in these United States of America. Today we celebrate the initial winning of our freedom. Yet what do we do with our freedom? Many of us question the influences of our liberty at any cost on the world stage. Who here has concerns about our overt and covert operations in attempts to bring freedom and democracy to countries in areas where we stand to lose access to natural resources or political clout? Recent polls declaring our population's dissatisfaction and distrust of our government are very interesting, and I'll make these comments about it. I wonder how you feel about our present government and situations that have come before us in these past 18 months? And how did you feel about our administration for the 8 years before that? Did anyone poll you to ascertain your level of satisfaction and trust? And are you in agreement with these current polls? This distrust in our present government seems a bit odd to me, given the evidence of people's disinterest in and lack of knowledge about our system of government. A succession of opinion polls have revealed that a majority of Americans are unable to name a single branch of government, whether it be executive or legislative or judicial. Nor can a majority describe the Bill of Rights, which helps understand why the Patriot Act was so easily put into law. And many have no understanding of the substance of that landmark Supreme Court case, Roe v. Wade, perhaps the most polarizing judicial decision in the last 40 years. Nearly half of adult Americans do not know that states each have two senators. And three quarters do not know the length of a senatorial term. More than 50% of Americans cannot name their representatives. And 40% cannot name one of their senators. American educator and author Mortimer Adler wrote that citizenship is the highest office of our government. All other offices, president, for instance, or chief justice of the Supreme Court, are the instruments by which we, the people, govern ourselves. The government of the United States resides in us. We, the people. What resides in Washington, D.C. is merely the administration of the government. We recognize this fact when, at the time of a presidential election, we say that we've changed administrations in Washington. But the government does not change. That's because the principal rulers of our nation, the citizens, are the permanent rulers, whereas the administration of the government is only temporary. This is the meaning of our freedom. That we, the people, have become our own rulers, the power behind the administration of the government. I remember traveling in Europe in the autumn of 2004, several months before the leading up to the presidential election. My European friends continually questioned me as to why I and we Americans were keeping this federal administration in power. And in answer to their queries as to how this could be, I could only retort with examples of our two-party system gone awry with influences of politics and lobbying and money. And these had stronger influences, it seemed, than the power of the vote of a single citizen. I felt the frustration that maybe some of you did. Especially when November 2nd rolled around and that same administration was given another 4 years. And that motivated me to work during the next few years, attending my precinct caucus in 2008 and personally contributing money and time and energy to elect someone to whom I felt more connected and whose policies more closely reflected my own. Now, I don't want this to be a political speech. And I know in our congregation here and among our Unitarian Universalists, there are people who voted for George W. Bush and that administration, and I honor their choice. And regardless of our political preferences, it's sometimes difficult to remember that in our system of government, the president is not a dictator, but actually works for the citizens and is limited by the Constitution. And on this Independence Day, we must remember that we, the people, are the ruling class in this country. Citizen is the highest office under the U.S. Constitution, and all other offices are secondary. Perhaps some of us, some of our citizenry, are asleep at the wheel when it comes to accountability for what our government is doing. This brings to mind the slogan, "My country, right or wrong." How many remember that one? It was one that was displayed in the early 70s during the end of the Vietnam conflict. And this simple phrase was used to polarize a generation during that time. History reveals that it was probably first stated as a toast by Commodore Stephen Decatur, Jr., who was an American naval officer, notable for his heroism in the Barbary Wars and the War of 1812. He was the youngest man to reach the rank of captain in the history of the United States Navy up until that time, and the first American celebrated as a national military hero who had not played a role in the American Revolution. Decatur said, "Our country, in her intercourse with foreign nations, may she always be in the right, but right or wrong, our country." There's another saying from Carl Schurz, who was a Union Army general and later served as U.S. Senator from Missouri and then later as Secretary of the Interior. Schurz said, "My country, right or wrong, when right, to be kept right, when wrong, to be put right." As citizen patriots, we love our country. And when the administration is leading the country in the wrong direction, we need to have the humility to admit it and the courage to put it right again. And as citizens, we have a duty to do so. Citizens come in all shapes and sizes, colors, and preferences. One complains that our government officials are proceeding along the worst course of action, flies a flag on all national holidays, and supports our troops with a sign on his tongue. Another donates to her political party, never passes up an opportunity to vote, and sports a "dissent is the highest form of patriotism" bumper sticker on her car. The relative patriotism of either is pretty much dependent upon our sympathy with their points of view. They have equal rights and claims to patriotism up to a point. If we hope to gain more out of being an American than patriotic fervor, and we also seek to be good Unitarian Universalists as well, then we must step out of the club mentality and engage in an endeavor that Immanuel Kant emphasized with his students 2.5 centuries ago. It was absolutely integral to the development of his philosophical views. Kant said, "Think for yourselves. Have the courage to make use of your own understanding." And this speaks to a level in us of motivation, that quality which many of us have little ability to understand in others, much less in ourselves. Let's look at our two patriots again. Many of us might assume the first gentleman to be not our favorite type of patriot. But let's assume that the flag-flying man assumes, let's assume that he questions the course of action of our government officials because he follows developments closely from a variety of sources. And he reads up on specific history. And he spends a great deal of time agonizing over what the right choice of action should be. And only after all of this reflection, he complains. Let's say that the second patriot supports her chosen political party and always votes along party lines because that's the way she's always done. It doesn't matter who's on the ballot, so long as she checks the right box concerning party affiliation. Voting to her may be a privilege without correlating responsibilities. So I want to bring that up today before we rush to judgment. I don't want to judge someone without understanding their motivation, and that takes putting a face on them and getting to know them. I want to look more deeply and ask what makes people tick. Beloved community, we may celebrate our freedom today, but there is much to do to fulfill the promise of our Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. For example, we have still not achieved justice for the First Nations of our land. and we are in the midst of a passionate but as yet unofficial immigration debate about people who are sometimes referred to as undocumented workers and by others as illegal aliens. And we face another threat, the power of corporations that have all the rights of citizens, but apparently few of the limitations. With massive wealth, they are able to purchase free speech through the media to an extent that they have far more power to influence the outcome of elections than real citizens have. Now, the Supreme Court, with its newly appointed members, has decided that purchased speech is free speech and cannot be limited. The promises of the Declaration of Independence. That all are created equal and possess certain inalienable rights. These are difficult promises to fulfill. Yet this is the promise of our America. Our government derives its just powers from the consent of the governed. We have, simply because we are human beings and citizens, the inalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And as citizens, we are rulers of our nation. We believe today that these promises are not just for white male property owners, as they were in the time of the early American Republic. They are promises for all women and men. It is our hope that in time such rights will be seen as the natural rights of all people, the world over, as our first hymn reflected. In the meantime, we still have work to do to fulfill these promises right here in our land. One last thought. In the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson wrote that the laws of nature and of nature's God entitled people to these inalienable rights. Jefferson, Washington, Madison, Franklin, Adams, all believed in God. At the same time, they were not fundamentalist or even orthodox Christians. See, they were all deists, dissenters, or religious liberals of one sort or another by the standards of most Americans of their time. A few, like Patrick Henry, were fairly orthodox. A few, like Thomas Paine, were so radical as to be anti-Christian. Jefferson, a deist, as you probably well know, declared himself to be a Unitarian when asked what he was. John Adams was a member of a church that became Unitarian during his lifetime, and he's buried in that church, the first parish Unitarian Universalist in Quincy, Mass. As is his wife, First Lady Abigail Adams, and his son, President John Quincy Adams, and his wife, First Lady Louisa Catherine Adams. Two presidents and two first ladies all buried in a UU church. And no other church in the United States can say that. Likewise, Washington, Franklin, Madison also held deist views. They believed in God, but they often preferred terms like providence and the term Jefferson used in the Declaration. The laws of nature and of nature's God. That's not a biblical phrase. It's a deist. Yet the founders were not as secular as some would like to think, nor are they as orthodox as others would like to think. As a group, it's fair to say that they did not believe, let's say it again. As a group, it's fair to say that they did believe that the laws of nature and of nature's God had endowed us with inalienable rights. They thought that religious faith was important and that it gave us morals and ethics and that these things were necessary for good government. But they did not want a test of faith to be required to hold political office. The Constitution makes this clear. They did not want a national religion. The Bill of Rights makes this clear. And as the Treaty of Tripoli clearly states, it was negotiated during the Washington administration, signed by President John Adams, and ratified without controversy by the Senate in 1797, the Treaty of Tripoli. They did not intend the United States to be a Christian nation. Rather, they wanted our nation to be a land of religious liberty and tolerance. And while they mentioned the laws of nature and of nature's God and the word creator in the Declaration of Independence, they left God out of the Constitution. In one of the last letters of his life, Jefferson wrote of America's hard-won freedom from kings who used church and state together to reign over others, acting as if only monarchs could call on the strength of God. On June 24, 1826, Jefferson wrote, "All eyes are open, or opening, to the rights of man. The general spread of the light of science has already laid open to every view the palpable truth that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God." Good old CJ. For the founding fathers, God's grace was universal, not limited to royal blood. And we owe a great debt to these founders. They were not gods. They were not perfect. They believed in liberty, but kept many slaves. They believed in virtue, but most lived very complex private lives. They all believed in the general idea of religion as a force for stability, but most had unconventional faiths. George Washington refused to kneel and pray, and he was not known to take communion. In fact, when a clergyman admonished him for not taking communion, he responded by ceasing to attend church. Still, he explained the victory of the Americans in the Revolution as the hand of Providence, going on at great length about how God had defeated the British Empire. These complex and self-contradictory people laid the groundwork for much good. We hold these truths to be self-evident. We have many promises to live up to. And we have the wisdom to fulfill the promises of the founders, to achieve the blessings of liberty, justice, and peace. And may we have the strength to pass on these blessings to our future generations. Being an American can help us live our UU principles, and being UUs can help us achieve what James Bryce expresses so beautifully. Our country is not the only thing to which we owe our allegiance. It is also owed to justice and to humanity. Patriotism consists not in waving the flag, but in striving that our country shall be righteous as well as strong. Happy 4th of July. Thank you for your attention and intention today, for your deep listening. I invite you to continue listening, and especially to these words of Václav Havel, a fellow Slav and freedom lover. These are from a book that was recently put together of an interview with him called Disturbing the Peace. The kind of hope I often think about, I understand above all to be a state of mind, not a state of the world. Either we have this hope within us or we don't. You see, it's a dimension of our soul. It's not essentially dependent on some observation of the world or estimation of the situation. Hope is not a prediction of the future. It is an orientation of our spirit, an orientation of our heart. It, in some ways, transcends the world that we immediately experience, and it's anchored somewhere beyond the day-to-day stuff. That's not right. He said beyond it to right. Hope, in this deep and powerful sense, is not the same as joy that things are going so well, or the willingness to invest in enterprises that are obviously headed for success, but rather it's an ability to work for something because it is inherently good, not just because it stands a chance to succeed. Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It's not the conviction that something's going to turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. That is this quote that now starts mine. Beloved sisters and brothers of this community, guests, future members of this community, let's continue our celebration of our freedom as we go forth in love and commitment and in hope and awareness.
This is a presentation of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. For more information, visit our website at www.austinuu.org.